Good morning. We begin this morning our summer series on the wisdom literature. For those of you who are visitors who have joined the parish since last year, for a number of years now we've been doing a summer series on the Tanakh. Because while the gospel is read in sequence, and we get to look at it in sequence, and even the epistles are read in sequence, whether it's a 4 weeks for a little one or 16 weeks for a big one, we at least get to give it some attention. The first readings are chosen to match the gospel, so they skip all over the lot. You might have Exodus 1 week, 1 Kings the next, Isaiah the week after that, Deuteronomy the week after that. So we decided some years ago to take a block of time and read the books of the Tanakh in order and think about them a little bit in order to see where they fit. We did Genesis the first year and Exodus the second. We did the rest of the Torah in the third year. The fourth year we did former prophets. Then we gave 1 year apiece to Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, one to the 12 prophets. And then last year we did the book of Psalms. Now we're doing 3 books, all wisdom literature, all of successive periods in Israel's life, and reflecting successive developments in the wisdom tradition. The book of Proverbs that we're going to look at this year, these next 2 weeks, then the book of Job, and finally the book of Qohelet, otherwise also known as Ecclesiastes, depending on which translation you're using. These books are different. They don't give us the sweeping historical drama of the Torah or the former prophets. They don't give us the detailed legislation of a book like Leviticus. They do not give us the stentorian, thus says the Lord, of the prophets. Rather, it's a gathering together and a distillation of things that people have learned over the years about how to make life better for themselves, for their families, for their people. It is wisdom literature. This first book is called Mishle. It's the plural of Mashal. Why the plural of Mashal turns out to be Mishle rather than Meshalim or Meshalot, I don't know, but it is. Proverbs, very often in the literal sense that we use the word Proverbs, as in this book mostly, it also can have a larger meaning. Parables, aphorisms, sayings, things like that. So these are largely Proverbs. A 31-chapter collection of them. First thing I want you not to do is to go home and read all 31 chapters. Reading 31 chapters of Proverbs in one sitting is like eating a whole box of very good chocolate in one sitting. What is delicious for the first or the second or the third, after a while it becomes a little too much, and finally you've got getting sick of it. Too much, too rich, too quickly. We've got 2 weeks. It's 31 chapters. If you read a couple chapters a day, works out fine. Read it in 4 or 5 chapter units once in a while, works out fine. Let me give you a tip for you. A tip given me years ago by an old monk. He said, when you read Proverbs, read with a pencil in your hand. And every time you come to one that sort of gets under your skin, make a tick mark in pencil on the margin. After you finish the book, go back and read all the ones that you tick marked and ask yourself, now what do these have in common? And that's probably what you need to work on for spiritual growth in the next year or two. It's the Proverbs that get the needle to us a little bit, that are the ones that we need to concentrate on the most. As you read them, you notice that they're very similar. Most of them are 2 lines. The whole collection of 2-line proverbs. Some 3. The 2-line proverbs are in ancient Hebrew poetic form. which means parallelism of thought and largely of word, either synonymous or antithetic. Now, synonymous parallelism, that's a very elaborate term for redundancy. As I was explaining it to Anastasia yesterday, Anastasia's very interested in these things, provided you can translate them into terms that cats are interested in. So I did. I said, okay, synonymous parallelism. It is good for cats to eat mice, for felines to feast upon rodents. She understood that. Simple, synonymous parallelism, the second line sort of restates what there is in the first line. Sometimes it runs the other way. Antithetic parallelism. The second line is the opposite or somewhat contrasted with the first line. The book has a proverb that says, "The secret of a king it is prudent to keep, but the glory of the Lord it is proper to declare." When you learn something private of the king's, keep your mouth shut, it's better for your health. When you learn something public of the Lord's, declare it openly, it is better for your spiritual welfare. Both true, but a certain amount of contrast to them. And then sometimes you get a three-step parallelism. Sometimes that's synonymous, synonymous, antithetic. This is this is this. This is this is this. But that is that is that. And sometimes it's sort of stair-step, good, better, best type parallelism. So as you read them through, the literary form becomes pretty comfortable after a while. You pick up on that. And then you start noticing not only the proverbs and their own application, but sometimes the arrangement. Sometimes the arrangement makes very little sense at all. They just appear to be sort of stuck together. But sometimes you'll notice that one comments on the next or the preceding. They do that to prevent too much misunderstanding. Proverbs are wonderful in that they boil things down to something that you can remember. On the other hand, a proverb used in the wrong place can be disastrous. So sometimes they'll match it with a contrasting proverb. The first proverb, for instance, may say that if you follow the way of the Lord, you will do well in life. But lest that sound like allowing you to assume that all the rich therefore have been favored by God and all the poor have not, the next proverb will say something like, "The one who takes compassion on his fellow is blessed by God, but the one who ignores the poor inherits a curse." That's the way of contrasting the first one, preventing it from being taken in the wrong direction. So you have to read them not only individually, but in relationship to each other. All of that will become, I think, fairly apparent as you begin to read through it. They're a long time in preparation. The book is ascribed to Solomon. Some of the individual parts of it are ascribed to Solomon. Some of those proverbs may actually go back to Solomon. As a whole, the book wasn't finished until about 500 years later. That's a long time in editing. But it's assembling all of these proverbs into a unit. What I think is perhaps most remarkable about it all is the attitude that it takes to wisdom. It was one that was remarkable then, and is, I think, remarkable now. A lot of people in those days, a lot of people in these days, would compartmentalize knowledge and choose one as real and dismiss the others as sort of nonsense. It was not uncommon for the scribes, the wise, those who were on the way in society, to consider religion sort of a minor nuisance. The king has to go to the temple. It's one of those things that kings have to do. But here are the ways that you really make this work. Realpolitik, separated from religion. And there were many religious people who thought all of this secular wisdom was just not worth really bothering with. What was really real
was to learn the Torah and do the Torah and everything would be all right. Same way today. There's a lot of religious people who think that religion is the only really valid form of knowledge. And if there's any kind of conflict, then other stuff all gets put aside. There are people who think that the earth is only 6,000 years old, because that's what it says in Genesis. Religious knowledge, the only kind that counts. Conversely, there are a lot of secular people who think that religion is simply old obscurantism and needs to be set aside. The less we think about it and the more we concentrate on real scientific knowledge, the better. And then there are a lot of people out there who think both of those are really sort of for the birds. And it's really only good common sense that you need to thrive and prosper and be happy in life. Don't go off with those eggheads or those religious fanatics. Just live by simple common sense and you'll do fine. So there's a lot of division, wisdom, today as there was way back then. But the genius of this wisdom literature is that it says, no, there is only one God. We are monotheists, you know. There's not one God who made this kind of stuff and you need that kind of knowledge, and a different God who made that stuff and you need that kind of knowledge. One God. And God made one world. All of it fits together. All of it is of a piece. Therefore, truth is one. Whether truth comes from philosophy or from common sense or from the Torah, if it's really true, then truth is one. The same attitude has been claimed in the best of the Jewish tradition since, and in the best of the Catholic tradition since. Hasn't always been true. We've had our triumphs of obscurantism, all right, you know, the Galileo case, little things like that. When I was in seminary, you passed the books of Teilhard de Chardin from one student to another in a brown paper bag. He was not yet considered safe to read. Although, at the same time, he was already beginning to influence the Vatican Council, then in session. So we've had our, let's chop knowledge up into pieces, concentrate on this one and ignore these other ones. But the best of our tradition has always said, it's all one. Bring it all together. Respect truth wherever you find it. Respect wisdom wherever you can discover it. And then look for ways to put it together. All the ways to put it all together will not be obvious. Not even within one field. Look at physics. They're still looking for the unified field theory. You can't bring together subfields in physics in one coherent set of equations. And that's just one field. How do you relate that to sociology or economics? Or biochemistry, or literature, all the various forms of secular knowledge that are out there. How do you unite all of that to the religious knowledge that comes down to us through our tradition? We have contact points, we have networking, we have ways of tying it together. But we certainly don't have it into a unified field theory, a theory of everything, for all kinds of knowledge, religious and secular, scientific and philosophical, commonsensical. But we're working on it. And it's a noble project. So as you read through Proverbs, appreciate the genius of that noble project and rededicate yourself to it. Look for truth wherever you can find it. Respect wisdom wherever you can discover it. In science, in philosophy, in literature, in common sense, in religion. And then look for the ways to tie it all together. Because as we grow in that tying together, we make life better for ourselves and for our world. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.